me tell you how it will be. There's one for you, 19 for me. 'Cause I'm the tax man. As the legislature prepares to pass a measure that levies a statewide 1% increase to the transient accommodations tax, and criticism of the deal comes in from around the islands, we asked HPR reporter Kuve Hiroishi to review the history of a tax that was originally proposed at 2% in the late 80s, quickly went to 5%, and is now, or will be, north of 10% if the legislature passes the rail bailout bill tomorrow. Kuve is with us in our studio.
Aloha, Chris.
Hi. We tend to think of the TAT as something that has been with us forever, but actually Hawaii was fairly late to the party among visitor destinations.
Yeah? That's correct. You would think, with the tourism being one of our leading industries, but it was 1987 that we finally jumped on the bandwagon, and that was at 5%. Now, before this, tourism was shared, or the cost of promoting Hawaii as a tourist destination was shared by members of the Hawaii's Visitors Bureau, which is now the Hawaii Visitors and Convention Bureau.
Right.
And it was all membership fees. But what they noticed was there was a free rider problem. So there were hotels and airlines that weren't willing to be a part of the membership, but were benefiting from the promotion.
Benefits.
Exactly.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So lawmakers got together and decided on a tax to have a centralized promotion mechanism.
And with everyone taking part.
Exactly. Exactly, including the tourists that come to Hawaii.
So. If you're going to benefit from it, you should put some money in, was the thinking, right?
It was. It was. And that continued to today. So now I think what I looked at, and I got a chance to talk to economics professor Carl Bonham over at UH. And what he's sort of told us is it's gone up. We know that. But the way that lawmakers have been able to look at it as this go-to tax when they need money for other things other than just tourism.
We've seen that with other funds, with the Hurricane Fund, right?
Right. So we had a couple of instances in the last 20 years where lawmakers did look to the TAT. One was when, if you remember, the Turtle Bay purchase, where we got the easement, conservation easement for Turtle Bay land to preserve some of that land. They dipped into the TAT. Also, when we were short on funds during the Great Recession in 2009 and 2011, we went ahead and upped the rate of the TAT. So it is a comfortable, let's say, politically feasible tax for our lawmakers to look to.
But it's run into some opposition, especially from neighbor islands, along the lines of why should we pay for Oahu's project, right?
Exactly. So the counties have always, it's always been a back and forth with the counties, but the counties came on in 1990. So that's when a distribution of the TAT revenues collected went to the counties, and it was 95% of what was collected.
And it was done as a percentage.
Exactly. It was done as a percentage. And then in maybe 2000, gradually, as we went, I think into 2000, the number of funds that were being created to take some of this TAT money that was collected would be taken off the top, and then the counties would get a percentage of the remaining revenue. And that is now, I believe, at 45% of what is collected goes to the counties. Now, what the counties are doing is they've got to pay for ocean safety, park maintenance, police, fire with the money to help with the visitors that do go to their islands. So they are looking at footing the cost of that. And when the money from the TAT does not come to them, they've still got to foot that cost.
Well, now the counties have to share a fixed annual figure.
Right.
$103 million.
Exactly. If this bill does pass, it will go back up to $103 million. So that number's been going up and down. And the permanent cap is what is proposed in this bill.
Yeah.
And that's something that I think the counties, you know, the counties don't want to see a cap on the money that comes in.
We talked to Kauai Council Chair Mel Raposo the other day, and he strenuously objected to that fixed number, you know, which doesn't make a lot of sense if you compare it to what you would get from a percentage arrangement,
right?
I would think.
Right, and that and the caps with numbers came in the right in the Great Recession is when they started to cap at 93, went up to 103, and back down to 93. So,
it's the background to all this would seem to be sort of competing needs of the state,
as is always the case for lawmakers,
and limited sources of revenue. You know, it almost seems as if we're reaching critical mass with some of these concerns.
Exactly, and I think a lot of the idea of having any project, so what if there's another public works project or another emergency where we need to tap into the funds, the number's only going to go up. And, you know, it's hard to know what we'll do with next.
When the well will run dry?
Exactly.
Thanks very much, Kuvei.
Thank you, Chris.
Kuvei Hiraishi is HPR's General Assignment Reporter. This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, we'll look at rail cost explosions. We're not alone. But first, here's your quiz.
In today's backyard quiz, we're picking the bright red blossoms of the firecracker hibiscus, also known as Turk's cap, because a bloom was said to resemble that felt fez worn by Turkish men. In the South Pacific, islanders call the plant sleeping hibiscus because the flower never fully opens up. Whatever name you choose to call it, you've most likely seen these beautiful blossoms along the roadside or maybe sewn together to make that vibrant Micronesian-style lei. A native of Central and South America, Turk's cap was introduced to Hawaii in the post-contact period, a little bit after 1778. This woody evergreen shrub grows up to 13 feet and boasts these scarlet blooms. They're about 2 inches long. It's the red blossom that's the most eye-catching, but there are cultivars in pink and white as well. Gardeners enjoy this nectar-rich blossom because a lot of pollinators flock to the yard and are very hardy, not wilting as quickly as other hibiscus. So for today, can you tell us the Hawaiian name of this flower? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know. The first one with the correct answer gets the HPR tote, letting everybody know that you got it right.
Musa in a Tulumatife, The Conversation Nana, Hawaii Public Radio.
Well, Well, Chris, we've been through a lot with rail, and we're dragging our neighbor islands into the fun now, too.
So it would seem.
Yep. You know, we've had some great conversations about it this week. Your talk with Randy Roth, Cliff Slater, and Mel Raposo. There are still so many questions swirling around overhead, and we were thinking it'd be nice to get a little perspective on the project. Mm-hmm. So we've been talking about funding all week. Chris, what we're thinking now is maybe a look from the outside might help. James Charlier is a transportation planner. He's the head of Charlier Associates based in Boulder, Colorado. They've worked internationally, Jakarta, Indonesia, for example, but most of their work is here in the U.S., in Houston, Los Angeles, suburbs, Phoenix, many more, but Jim lives in Colorado. Charlier was invited to Honolulu about 12 years ago, actually, to work on zoning, and he did the planning for the Ho'opili project that's out there. They're done with that now. Mm-hmm. But his experience in transit nationwide, I thought, would offer perspective on our rail cost explosion.
This problem of cost overruns and escalating costs far beyond the original budget, that has almost become a characteristic of developing a major transit system. For example, Fast Tracks, 113-mile regional rail system in Denver, is moving forward and has had an enormous impact on the region. That system is costing billions of dollars more than it was originally supposed to. That caused incredible political turmoil and battles, and it was part of mayoral races and debated in the legislature. And those of us who work in transportation have concluded that we have to get much better at that, or we're just going to completely lose any public support for making major investments.
Mm-hmm. He did say, Chris, as we suspected, that lowballing on the front end is sort of industry practice. It has been. And he also says that major freeway and highway projects have suffered this same fate.
To some degree, what's happened is that building major transportation capital investments, pick your project, have become much harder to do than they used to be. The process is much more difficult. The kinds of mitigations and management strategies that are required become much more demanding than they used to be. That acceleration and increase in the demands placed on those projects has, I think, outpaced our ability to implement them.
And when we're looking at the project that we have coming into downtown Honolulu, it's easy to imagine something like that happening.
Well, it's easy to overlook pitfalls that are yet to come, and chances are you're not going to build too much based on speculation as to what could go wrong, but things have a way of going wrong, right?
And he's saying it is very, very hard to anticipate.
Sure.
And he was going on to say that, talking about an avenue that a lot of jurisdictions like to explore for helping to fund the process, and that is public-private partnerships. He says it's not a panacea. They've had mixed results in the Denver area, but it is something that people here might want to consider. Well, Inside Heart is where we have not been able to go to search for reasons that the price hikes have gone so astronomical lately. But Simon Zweighaft used to be in there. He began work on Honolulu's transit project in 07. He was project manager for the Honolulu High Capacity Transit Corridor Project. That's the pre-HART entity. Well, Zweighaft was a principal with InfraConsult, which was the rail project program manager, and he helped review decisions by the rail designers. That's Parts and Sprinkerhoff. He worked for HART until 2014-2015.
People are wondering, how do we get so astronomically over budget? And
well, I'm wondering that myself.
Are you?
I haven't, as when I left the project, it was considered to be on budget. And in the 2.5 or 3 years, whatever the length of time it is since I've left, the costs have escalated astronomically. And I personally don't understand what all the reasons are. I have heard that construction escalation was much higher in Honolulu than we had forecast. We had forecast about a 4% annual cost of inflation. And my understanding is it was well over 10% for some of those years. Also, we forecast the project would be completed much earlier than it was. And, of course, it underwent some substantial delays. That would drive the costs up. I frankly don't have a good handle on why the cost increased so much in the last several years.
Well, another principal in this rail story, longtime city transportation director Toru Hamayasu, has said this project was on target when he left the city at the end of 2012. That's the year that Dan Grabauskas signed on as CEO of the Honolulu Authority for Rapid Transportation. Grabauskas resigned in August last year amidst concerns about the growing $6.5 billion rail budget. He left after a scathing report by the city auditor. Well, now people at heart are saying, forget the past, just figure a way forward. The thing is, if Honolulu can handle rail costs without default, there may still be one more question, Chris.
At another level, it's an important question to say, if we're going to spend $8 billion on a rail system, what might we have spent that $8 billion on that might have yielded a higher rate of return? And I think that's always a valid question. That's always something we should ask. And frankly, it doesn't always get asked. And I think it's fair, you know, when you're part of the way through something and the costs keep escalating, you have to kind of keep raising that because that's just responsible political leadership. But at some point, we lose sight of the benefits that the project that we're building is supposed to have. And we forget that if we bail out and don't complete the project, we're bailing out of the benefits as well. So I think it's a tough decision.
Charlier says that it's rarely a viable option to bail out on a mega project once it's started. But, geez, Chris.
We're seeing that played out, certainly,
mm-hmm.
aren't we?
Or is it the time for us to really take that look he's talking about and ask the question of whether this $10, $12, $13 billion could be better spent? We don't know, but that is certainly a conversation that continues here. Find more in Hawaii Public Radio's continuing coverage of rail at hawaiipublicradio.org or on the Facebook conversation page.
One president's so-called dreamer is another president's illegal immigrant, as more than 500 young Hawaii residents are learning. President Trump has vowed to end the Obama-era program that gives young undocumented immigrants temporary legal status under the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA. That leaves at least 500 young people here wondering what to expect. With a presidential decision on DACA expected as early as this week, Civil Beat reporter Louis Kaneda talked with a young man from Zimbabwe about his future in today's reality check. Hi, Louis. How are you?
Good morning.
You obviously wanted to get a personal story, you know, find out what the personal impact of this is by talking to this young man. What did you find out?
Well, I talked to Shingai Masia. He is from Zimbabwe, as you said, and he has been very vocal about this issue, talking about how critical this piece of executive action done by President Obama is for him and almost 800,000 people around the country is. And we here in Hawaii, we have somewhere in the short of 600 people who have benefited from this program, and it basically gives them a legal status, temporary legal status that let them live here and work here. And they were brought here usually by their parent, undocumented, when they were minor. And that's the kind of the qualification to be eligible for this program.
Well, what's going to happen to them if DACA is canceled by the president?
Well, it all depends on how he does it, and you know, whether he just going to rescind everything that President Obama did, or maybe, you know, he does it in phases. But basically, you know, bottom line is that they will most likely be subjected to deportation at some point in time. At this point, like I said, 800,000 people are given the temporary status, the legal status, that let them work for 2-year period, and that can be renewed. And the option here is that President Trump can stop accepting the new applications, or even, you know, refusing to renew these 2-year thing. Or I suppose, you know, there could be an option of just totally gutting this program to the point that even if you have this 2-year permit, you might be already get subjected to deportation. I'm sure there will be some legal challenges to anything that he will try to do. But, you know, right now we are at the critical point because there is this kind of ultimatum being hung over the president's head, because the Texas Attorney General has written a letter basically saying, you know, if you don't rescind this program by next week, we're going to file the legal challenge. You know, that's kind of tying his hand at the moment.
Who would do the deporting if it comes to that?
Well, that would be the Homeland Security Department and, you know, their immigration agencies. And, you know, it all depending on, like I said, the sort of the scenarios and ways in which that he tried to go about gutting this program. And by no means, you know, it is a done deal that, you know, he is going to scrap this program. He has said during the last few months that, you know, he feels for these kids and, you know, these are the incredible kids. That's his quote. And that, you know, he's not really, his policy isn't so much about going after these guys, but going after the criminals. But at the same time, he campaigned on the promise that he is going to gut this program. So, you know, he's kind of sending a mixed messages here. And so, you know, it's anyone's guess what he's going to do by next week.
Well, we'll look to you to let us know how it all plays out, Louis. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
Every day we bring you a reality check from Civil Beat. Today we spoke with Civil Beat reporter Louis Caneda.
Over the first 7 months of the Trump administration, there have been a number of foreign leaders who have come to the White House. But the first dignitary to be hosted for a formal dinner at the White House was Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi in late June. It's symbolic of a bilateral relationship that's been drawing closer even before the Trump administration took office. Since he took office in 2014, Prime Minister Modi has visited the United States 5 times, more than any other country. Joining us to talk more about that relationship is India's ambassador to the United States, Navtej Sarna, in town for an event at the East-West Center. Mr. Ambassador, thanks for joining us. You have spoken of the U.S.-India global partnership. How do you see where that partnership is now, and how do you see it developing?
Well, yes, I think the relationship that we have today is quite unique. It is very strong on a bilateral wicket. But what we mean by global partnership is that it addresses in strong convergence most of the issues that the world faces today. And this was very much evident during the visit of Prime Minister Modi and his discussions with President Trump and the documents that were issued after the visit. So I think in terms of facing the challenges, whether they be of global terrorism, whether they be of issues of maritime security, whether they be of the freedom of the seas and navigation and connectivity issues, these are all issues which democracies have to handle, and it becomes much easier if they handle them together.
Part of that evolving world of which you speak, Prime Minister Modi traveling to China next week, taking part in that so-called BRICS summit, Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa. China and India recently backed off a border dispute with a complicated history, but clearing the way for that visit. How would you characterize the current state of Indian-Chinese relations, and how do you see that playing into that broader multilateral picture that you were drawing?
Well, we have a very broad-based relationship with China, which is multilateral aspects also, and also strong economic and investment ties. And as you rightly said, we have recently resolved an issue at the border through diplomatic channels. BRICS is something which faces many of the challenges of the world, and this was it gives a platform for major emerging economies to come together and to address these issues. So we're looking forward to the visit and to the discussions in China.
There are some who have theorized that the closer relationship of the United States and India is seen as a bit of a counterweight to China's influence in the region. What would you say to that?
Well, I'm not very sure whether it is very useful to see these relations through the prism of any other relationship. I think the India-U.S. relationship has a strong logic of its own. It's a relationship between the world's largest and the world's oldest democracies. It's a relationship based on a convergence of fundamental values, freedoms, individual liberties, between two major federal nations. It is a relationship which is based on looking at the economic and convergences over the coming years. And of course, there is a very strong people-to-people link now that we have a very successful and increasingly powerful diaspora of about 3 million people of Indian origin in the United States. So I would rather take this relationship on its own basis and not look at it through the prism of any third country.
Taking it on its own basis for a moment, right now the Assistant Secretary of State for South and Central Asian Affairs is an acting position in the United States. Many other senior State Department positions are unfilled or filled with personnel working in an acting capacity. As the U.S. ambassador of a major power, do you feel that absence of senior personnel and of some experienced career foreign service personnel in the United States?
Well, I think this is a matter for the administration to decide upon, and it is not my position to comment on this matter. What I can say is that we have been able to continue the relationship in a very successful manner in the last few months, as would be evident from the very closely choreographed visit of the Prime Minister and subsequent contacts between the two administrations.
You know, you were stationed at the Indian Embassy in Washington from 1998 to 2002 as a minister counselor that stretched during the second Clinton administration, the first Bush administration.
That's right.
How would you compare that time and this in terms of U.S.-Indian relations?
Well, I think that was the beginning of the turnaround, if I may say so. And from then on, these relations have progressed from strength to strength. So if I look back to that time, I think the relationship today is much richer, much more broad-based. It is engagement in almost every field of human activity. There is tremendous convergence and mutual respect for each other's positions. So I think whether we look at the political engagement, we look at the economic engagement, all major corporates based in the U.S. are engaged in India. And whether we look at what we are doing in terms of science and technology, space, the cyber world, the medicine world, I think there is a sea change in the relationship from then and now. And in that sense, we have, the relationship has thrived in different administrations, both in the U.S. as well as in India. And in fact, with each sort of change, democratic change, somehow it has become even more stronger than before.
One Hawaii-specific question. India has big plans for solar energy. The Prime Minister has a good deal of experience in putting solar into play in Gujarat State when he was chief minister there. But the vast majority of India's energy still comes from coal. Is there anything in Hawaii that you're watching or paying attention to when it comes to solar or any other alternative energy sourcing? And is there any room for cooperation between Hawaii and India in that area?
Well, although I haven't had any specific discussions on energy in Hawaii, I did have energy discussions in my visit to Alaska and to Texas earlier. But we would be open to any ideas and proposals that we could get for cooperation in energy. We do have dependence on coal and oil and gas, but we also have very ambitious plans of bringing in renewable energy up to the tune of 175 gigawatts of energy by 2022 will come from renewable sources, including solar and wind. So yes, we would be open to any proposals that we could get for cooperation in any energy domain. India is an energy-hungry country, and given our growth rates of over 7% now for the coming decades, I think we would be needing energy for the foreseeable future.
Mr. Ambassador, thanks very much for spending some time with us today.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
Navtesh Sarna is the Indian ambassador to the United States. He's a veteran of more than 35 years in the Indian Foreign Service, having served as ambassador to the United Kingdom and Israel, as well as in postings around the world, from Moscow and Warsaw to Tehran and Washington. He's also a writer of novels, short stories, and criticism, and among his academic credentials is a diploma in journalism.
Gerard Elmore is an Emmy-nominated writer, editor, producer, director. He's worked on television, film, and commercial projects. He's also the executive director of the Ohina Short Film Showcase that gives a leg up to local filmmakers in Hawaii. Welcome, Gerard.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, and thanks for bringing in Aaron Lau, a Sundance Institute Native Lab Fellow, UH Academy for Creative Media alum. She's written and directed award-winning shorts, which have screened in New Zealand, France, Shanghai, other places, right, Erin? Yeah. And she's one of the filmmakers featured in the showcase tomorrow night. Welcome to both of you.
Thanks again.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
Well, Gerard, can you just give us an overview of the landscape of short films? Who makes them and where do they screen?
Sure. You know, right now we have films that come from ACM. Yep. ACM.
Academy for Creative Media at UH.
Yep. And West Oahu. And then we have professional filmmakers who make it on their free time, and some raise funds to create their short films. And that's the range that's at Ohina.
Okay. What do they usually do with these works of art here, these gems, these short gems?
And that's a great question. Usually filmmakers make short films as a calling card to show people what they can make, different stories that are not so mainstream. To get themselves out there. And we're here to help them show their films.
I see. What would they normally do with them aside from Ohina? Email them to people? Or?
Yeah, you know, back in the day, that's kind of how I started. but now you have YouTube and Vimeo, but you have to create an audience. And
yes.
That's the tricky part. So,
how do you do that?
Part of it is being on this radio show and saying, hey, you know,
come
we're
to
here,
a showcase tomorrow night.
Right. Get the eyeballs to see this work all in one place. And then the filmmakers have to develop a following. And short films help them to build a portfolio. It's actually how I got started as a filmmaker.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Is that what you're trying to do now, Aaron?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So you sort of establish a style in the type of stories you tend to focus on.
Mm.
And then from there, you'll go on Facebook or Vimeo and you'll post these things up. And as Gerard said, a lot of the times we'll go to festivals because that's how we can actually get audiences. Otherwise, nobody's going to come to your page.
Mm,
and for a lot of filmmakers, the goal is once you've built this portfolio, you can start to work towards a feature and really start to, like, boost your career forward.
Aha. Uh-huh. Well, what's cool is you've kind of followed a pathway that actually exists in Hawaii for, you know, aspiring filmmakers. Where did it start for you, Erin?
Actually, when I was in high school, I saw my first high-quality local short called Stones by Tai Songa. And it had a profound effect on me because I guess I had never thought I could make a story about home or something relevant to our community here, and it could be of great quality and affect people around the world. And it just kind of was shocking. And from there, I decided I want to do that. And so I decided I would pursue filmmaking in college. I went to UH. I've got my degree in creative media there, and now I'm doing my master's at Chapman. And like, the people I've met here in Hawaii, including Gerard, who was one of my professors, have really supported me into telling stories about here and who I am. And I think that helps empower our community by getting to share who we are and where we come from.
Was there something about the Academy for Creative Media, ACM, that helped you to focus? Because that is a hard thing to do as a filmmaker, right? What's special about me?
So, and especially in this industry that's so competitive and you've got film students across the globe, you have to ask yourself, what sets me apart? And in our, here in Hawaii, we have such unique experiences with our melting pot community to our culture. And so I just needed to step back and ask myself, who am I? What matters to me? And try to put that on the screen.
What have your films been about? Just quick synopses.
So a few different films. Little Girl's War Cry played at Ohina, and that focused on domestic violence against women and children, which is a prevalent issue in Pacific communities. One of my past films, Day Pass, focused on a Japanese-American family and a brother and sister bonding after she gets put in a rehab institute. And so a little bit of it is it's still very personal stories about relationships and struggle, but put in the context of Hawaii and how our differences kind of add into that, like culture on the top.
Wow. Gee, that is a different spin on it, isn't it? Gee, you've been doing this now for about 17 years, Gerard. Over that span of time, how have these, like, these first glimpses so intimately into people's lives? Because you can make a, it's kind of doable, right, to make a short film. So you would think people would try things in this arena.
Yeah. And that's actually kind of the theme this year. The theme is tell your story, because I firmly believe everyone has a story to tell. And our stories in Hawaii are very unique. Just sometimes people don't have the resources or the capability to put that film together. So I like to think that there might be someone walking down the street that has the next blockbuster in their brain, but they just never picked up a camera or had the chance to make a film. And that's part of what Ohina is about, which is giving that venue, giving that voice to people.
How easy can it be? I mean, is this, we're talking phone shot video? And
well, it's actually very doable. We went to Lana Kila Pacific, and the clients there have special needs. And we went there, and we created short films. Ah. And they never picked up a camera. They've never made a story, never did anything. And they were able to create their own films. They had their own ideas. They created their own films. And
their perspective, that's what I want to see.
And that I firmly believe anyone can do it. It's just, it's always comes down to what's the long journey of a filmmaker is having what's in your brain translated to screen. That's what takes years and honing your craft, and that just takes a long time.
I just love how Ohina is taken into these, getting into the incubation business a little here. Tell us quickly about the writer's workshop you've got this time around.
Yeah, it's very exciting. It's the first time we're ever doing it. We have Joe Robert Cole coming. He's actually one of the writers from Marvel's Black Panther.
Ooh.
Yeah, and he's a very hot writer right now, and that's a very hot movie that's coming out. He's actually coming down. He's seen all the films from the Ohina selected shorts, and he's going to be working one-on-one with certain filmmakers to help create their next short films. It's the first time we're ever doing it, and then Ohina's going to pick one to help produce Hawaii Camera and certain sponsors are coming to sort of pitch in to help make that happen.
I'm so proud of the growth of the Ohina Film Festival, and I just have to do shout-outs. I hope people will check the sponsor page of your website, because these people deserve a pat on the back, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So we're going to see some terrific films on tomorrow night?
The judges say they're fantastic. Terry Hunter did a great little piece and reviewed them all and said there's not a weak link.
Oh, no and, kidding. Where can we see some previews?
If you go on our website, there's a little synopsis and things like that. There's not really any previews because they're short films. But, like I said, Terry said they're fantastic. I actually try not to see them, but I think they're going to be really good.
All right. These two here are writers, editors, producers, and directors all in one. Aaron Lau and Gerard Elmore. With news about the 2017 Ohina Short Film Showcase. It's happening tomorrow night, 7 p.m. at Hawaii Theater. See you there.
Thanks for having us.
Aloha, I'm Bianca Dukeshire from Honolulu, Hawaii. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Earlier in the program, we told you about the Turk's cap hibiscus, Malvaceae hibiscus rosa sinensis, first introduced sometime after Western contact was made, has since flourished, blossoming year-round. The scarlet flowers never completely unfurl, always seeming to look ready to burst into bloom, but they never do. Gardening enthusiasts are fans of this plant because the nectar-rich flowers attract a great many bees, butterflies, and birds. The blossoms don't wilt as easily as other hibiscus, making them ideal for lei. Earlier, we asked you to tell us the Hawaiian name for Turk's cap hibiscus. If you look at the long tubular flowers, they resemble firecrackers. And the Hawaiian name, alo alo pahu pahu, literally translates to hibiscus firecracker.
Pua Pinto knew that. She'll be sporting our winner's bag, Chris.
Good for her.
She called from Kailua.
That's today's quiz. If you've got one for us, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Hi, I'm Zach Diana from Dreamhouse Eva Beach Charter School. Hear the conversation live or anytime you want on HPR's mobile app. Find it in the Apple App Store or Google Play.
Stories of forbidden love, where unlikely heroes are rewarded and love eventually conquers all, live down through the ages for a reason. Quasimodo, the deformed Notre Dame bell ringer who lives in the cathedral's bell tower, is a stand-in for everyone who has ever felt marginalized and misunderstood. The story of his doomed love for the fair Esmeralda has all the outlandish situations and extravagant emotions that a good theatrical musical needs. And the show is coming to the Maui Academy of Performing Arts under David Johnston's direction. He's on the line with us now. Hi, David. Thanks for talking with us.
Hi, Chris. It's great to be with you.
I should say the show is already underway, right? How's it going?
It is underway. We're at the halfway point, actually, and it's going just super. We're really excited about it, and it's an epic production, and the response from the audience has been terrific. So...
It would have to be an epic production given the story, wouldn't it?
It does indeed.
How do you manage to recreate, for instance, the cathedral on a stage set?
Well, that's a very interesting question. We struggled with that when we got together, the artistic team, back in May, and we're looking at how do we create this magnificent cathedral. And one of the things that kept coming up over and over in the conversations and from looking at the script was the mention of the height of the rooms that the characters were in and how they're looking out over Paris.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it became, you know, an essential component that we somehow reflect that in the visuals on stage. So where we landed was using scaffolding and a concept of how these grand cathedrals and buildings, this magnificent architecture, is always under construction.
Mm-hmm.
So we took that idea and used the scaffolding as the basis to create, you know, three stories on the stage. And the concept is that the building is under construction, and these scaffoldings are just part of the daily life of the people who are involved in the cathedral.
It makes a lot of sense, and it's also it's essential to the story, because the story has, it's very important which level, and I mean, people are on. There are people on the ground. There's Quasimodo way up high in the bell tower, but the whole idea of elevation and what elevation characters are at is really part of the whole story itself, isn't it?
It is indeed, yes. And there's that sense we've been able to create with, you know, just that separation, and I think this is what you're referring to a little bit, is that separation of Quasimodo's isolation up in the bell tower,
right,
and his alienation from the rest of the community and his separateness,
yeah,
his otherness. Yeah.
You have to create some sort of illusion, at least, of physical separateness, don't you?
We do, yes. And everything's on, you know, excuse me, the entire set, basically, because of the way the scaffolding is constructed, are on wheels. So these scenes just flow quickly from one scene to another, almost sometimes with you know, two measures of music to get from inside the cathedral to the Court of Miracles outside the cathedral. So it was, how do we facilitate that happening? And by putting everything on wheels, we're able to move the action very quickly and very smoothly between the scenes with, you know, no blackouts where we change massive sets.
This is a story whose protagonist, Quasimodo, is you know, not your standard matinee idol. What is it that draws us to him?
Well, I think part of the fascination of this entire story, which really reflects on the condition and the place we are in our society right now,
mm-hmm,
is that sense of otherness, you
yeah
know, and that separation that we have, that people who are different from us are a threat to us, or they're scary to us, or we are better than them, so we put them down,
mm-hmm,
in order to raise ourselves up. So I think it's touching on all of those issues. I think it's an incredible metaphor, but that's part of the reason the story's lasted so long, is that the deformity of Quasimodo is just a reflection of our own fears and a manifestation of our own fears and feelings, that when we see people, we encounter people who are different from us, we have a reaction to that.
Well, if you get too concerned about otherness and you start marginalizing everyone who is other than yourself, you might find out that you yourself are on the margins, right?
That is exactly true. And we had great conversations in rehearsals about that very thing. When was the last time you were the Quasimodo, when you were on the outside, when you were the other who was being mocked or isolated or shunned?
Mm-hmm. Surprising how many people can think of something in their own experience that makes them feel that way, isn't it?
It is. I think we all have them, don't we? I know
everybody I know.
Back in my life, I can identify them.
Absolutely, absolutely. Is that, you know, the, I mean, on first blush, this is a pretty outlandish story of a place and time far away. It's not the sort of thing that is particularly familiar to our everyday experience. But that whole thing of the person on the margins, is that what has given this story life down through the generations?
I think it has. It's so integrated into the entire story. And to me, it's all of that issue is so entwined in the love issues, you know, in the story. So I think that that's what's carried us through. It's really, really fascinating. When we started working on this, it was, you know, because a big chunk of the story is about the gypsies coming to Paris. Mm-hmm. And Frollo, who is the caretaker of Quasimodo, is high in the church hierarchy, and he wants to rid Paris of all of these undesirables, these gypsies. And so the parallels right now between what's going on in our world are pretty striking.
That they do seem to be, David. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Hey, my pleasure.
David Johnson is the director of the Maui Academy of Performing Arts production of The Hunchback of Notre Dame, which runs for one more weekend at the Castle Theater in Kahului. You can get details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
What do you know of me? What do you know of all the things I feel? You're only made of stone. Who is it that you see? Instead of seeing what I am.
One of the staffers asked me if I would consider giving a monthly donation, and I realized that I would be able to give more to the station with a smaller payment over a longer period of time than I would be able to with one large one. And I thought, this is great. I don't have to go into debt. I don't have to pay off a charge card or whatever, and it's affordable and it's easy, so why not? I'm Carrie Taggart, and I'm proud to be a sustaining member of Hawaii Public Radio.
And that's it for today's edition of The Conversation. On tomorrow's agenda, government reporter Wayne Yoshioka looks back at a dizzying week of debate on rail.
Ooh, plus we'll hear about an architect who shaped the modern face of Cambodia with some pretty daring architecture. And we'll hear about the great modernist-era buildings that give downtown Lihue its distinctive look.
We like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at this number, 808-792-8217. You also can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation.
And if you missed any of this show or want a past one, find them on the Conversation Facebook page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for the Conversation on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Noe Tanigawa.
I'm Chris Vandercook. Meet us in the morning for more of The Conversation.